night, everyone. It's Tuesday, November 5th, Election Day. Make sure you exercise the franchise. That might be just a school board election or a mayor or a selectman, but in the end, it trickles up. So make sure you make an informed decision and you actually participate, because then you might find yourself with a selectman that only got like one more vote than the other guy, and you're like, how is it possible he or she won? I mean, you just sit there and sort of kick yourself. Anyway, this is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. It is a little overcast. It's a little cool, but wet. And it's an exciting day for me. I haven't seen my daughter in over 3 years from Shanghai. So she arrives today and flies in. And she's getting married, as I think I've told some people. She's getting married in New Jersey in 2 weeks. And why is she getting married in New Jersey? Because her 99-year-old grandmother, who will be 100 in December, lives in a nursing home. And she realized that if she didn't get married right by the nursing home, her grandmother would not be able to attend. So we're having a pop-up wedding. I swear to God, that's how she's calling it. It's a pop-up wedding in like a field right by the nursing home. Unbelievable. Only in my family do we do these things.
That is so cool.
It is actually very cool.
I think it's just the sweetest thing.
It is. And her grandmother is an Iowa farm girl. Her name, I love her name. Her name is so Iowa. Winifred. Oh, my God. It's just like at a little house on the prairie. You know what I mean? And she kind of looks like a Winifred. So it's so when people ask me about Iowa, I actually have relations in Iowa, because half my, you know, my family has. My daughter went to the University of Iowa, and it turns out so did her. Her grandmother was raised there. So
wow. Cool. Wow. Yeah. You know, I had an Aunt Winnie, too, an Aunt Winifred.
Really?
My great aunt. Yes.
Really?
Yes,
my grandmother's
sister. I love those
old names. Yeah. I should have come up with an old name. Oh, well, forgive me, Melissa. But I have to tell everyone, my real name is Deborah, which is Hebrew for honeybee. And and Melissa is Greek for honey from the bee.
Oh, wow. Did you know that?
Of course. I do all my homework. I was hoping it was going to be a boy, and I was going to name him after Baryshnikov and call him Misha. I love that name, too.
Yes,
anyway, all right, now that you know my entire history, God, Arnie, you know, convey everything. All right, so where are we going with you today,
including your predilection for Russian names.
I know. I love Russian names, you know.
That's great. So I have been thinking, as everybody is talking about impeachment of Donald Trump, so what happens, let's say, God willing, he gets impeached and leaves office. And, you know, we've talked about this before. Who becomes president? Well, guess what? It's Mike Pence. And is that a good thing? And yet, nobody is actually investigating Pence, even though it's pretty clear his hands are, well, he's up to his chest in evil activity. He was Trump's bag man going to Ukraine.
Yeah.
He went there after Trump cut off the foreign aid to Ukraine that had already been appropriated by Congress. And he told Zelensky that we are going to be watching you and to see you root out corruption.
And corruption has only one name, Biden. Only one name, Biden. That's the extent of corruption for Trump.
Right. And that is, in fact, what Trump has pretty much made clear after that. And Pence is over there basically doing the dirty work like Giuliani was for Trump, in between Trump's deciding to cut off the money and Trump's trying to get the Ukrainians to investigate his political rival.
Right.
So why isn't the Southern District of New York or somebody, the FBI, I know why they're not investigating, but his name is Bill Barr, but it's criminal. So, I mean, literally criminal.
So here's a couple of things. The allegiance is not to Pence. It is to Trump. It will be a very – if he's removed, it will be months after we're in election mode. I don't see Pence as carrying the banner of the GOP into the election. There will be frustration and anger, but it will not be it'll be about the removal of Donald Trump. And I think you're absolutely right. You know what really bothers me? And make sure I'm correct on this, but I think I read – that, you know, how they keep saying, well, they released the money anyway and Ukraine got the money, so what's the big deal?
Mm.
And I'm pretty sure this is accurate. You might want to check on Google. But my understanding is that they decided to release the money like 24 hours after the whistleblower's memo dropped. Think about that.
I think that's right.
So think about that. It wasn't like they were going to release the money. They needed to release the money after they were fingered.
Right.
And what I don't understand about the Democratic Party is that there are certain nuggets of information that need to be told over and over and over again. Adults are like children, everyone. We learn through repetition. The brilliance of Donald Trump is that he repeats his lies over and over so well that his people know them and I know them. Okay? This is how good he is at teaching us his lies. We are so bad at teaching the facts. And if you are going to be bad at teaching the facts, then don't be angry at the population that doesn't believe the facts because they haven't, one, heard them enough. They've heard the lies more than they've ever heard the truth. And you don't have to give them everything. But there are certain kernels of knowledge that if repeated over and over again, if this were your kid, you would know exactly what they were doing. If this was your boss, you would know exactly what they were doing. Well, this is your president. Understand what the hell he is doing. And I want to just say a pox on the Democratic Party. They do not know how to fight. He is brilliant. People keep saying he's not smart. No, he is brilliant.
Oh, he
because
is.
He knows how to play the game. And you would think that by now we would have learned it.
Yeah. I mean, he's brilliant at brilliant at some things. He is brilliant at marketing.
Oh, yeah.
At public relations. He
Absolutely.
Is brilliant at, as you said, brainwashing people by saying the same lies over and over again and saying it. You know, he says it in this confident manner like it's obviously true. You know, I had a professor in law school who said, if you have the facts on your side, pound the facts. If you have the law on your side, pound the law. If you don't have either, pound the table.
And
that is what Trump does. He pounds the table. By God,
I'm the
greatest.
But let me just say something. So if you watch MSNBC and CNN, see that statement you just made? I've heard that 5,000 times. I'm sick of that statement. I hate that statement. If that's the statement, then what the hell are you doing about it? Honest to God, everybody says it to the point where I want to throw something at the television set. I don't want to hear about the statement that you made that your professor said about the fact that if you don't have the facts and you don't have – you pound the table. I'm sick of pounding the table.
I'm not suggesting that's a good idea. I'm saying that's what Trump is good at and it is succeeding. And the Democrats – I was going to respond to your point about the Democrats who are spineless as you put it, they aren't comfortable pounding the table. They basically aren't comfortable sounding like, I'm confident, I'm right, you're wrong, and this is the truth. They sort of say it in this
like
kind of
apologetic
caution.
Way. Oh, my
God.
But it's not
Well,
it's not even the apology. It is, I am just telling you, everyone, there are certain things that should be repeated every single day. There should be ads. There should be billboards. Look what he does when he has a speech. Read the memo. Remember? Read the transcript or whatever.
That's something I want to throw the TV at.
Exactly.
He's the one that put the memo in a top secret box that nobody can get access to.
And we know
read
it's
the
not,
transcript.
It's not a transcript.
Well,
it's a memo.
No, but you know, there is a whole one in this box and it won't get released. And then he has the gall, the chutzpah to say to people, go read this thing.
Let's grab.
I've hidden it and I've made it impossible to access. But if
you
want to know the facts underlying my position, go look at this impossible to access thing.
We are going to lose because we do not know how to win. Because we do not know how to educate the population. We know how wrong he is, but we think we're the only ones that need to know. No, sweetheart. Mm. The rest of us need to know. You don't give me 1,000 facts, give me 5. But I want them 5 morning, noon, and night so I can repeat them to my grandchildren. They do not do that. I'm so angry.
But excuse me, we also need to do it, as you said, repeat the facts. Not what the Democrats repeat is this guy is heinous, this guy is a bad guy.
I don't want an opinion. He's corrupt.
He's a
sexist.
That's
an opinion.
Exactly. That's what I mean.
I agree.
Need to repeat the facts.
All right. We got to grab our first guest. He's looking at us like we're already halfway through his thing. So I love Harold Meyerson. And the fact that Harold Meyerson wrote a piece that had New Hampshire's name in its title meant that I had to grab him at the American Prospect. But before we grab Harold, let me just share something with you. I saw something at the LA Times this morning, and I was like, oh, my God, I want to vomit. I want to vomit. You ready, everyone? Here is the headline. Go to the LATimes.com. It's an environmental story, sort of, but not really. Trump team has a plan for national parks. Are you ready? Amazon, food trucks, and no senior discounts. Wow, why didn't I think of that? Amazon, food trucks, and no senior discounts. If you were sitting here right now looking at me, you would see my middle fingers up in stereo. That's all I'm telling you right now. You would just be like, oh, God, Arnie is so ticked off. Do me a favor, grab the LA Times piece or go to the Attitudes page on my Facebook page and you can link to it because I actually have it hyperlinked. So go grab it. But, I mean, look at this. I mean, let's just call us a monarchy. Let's get rid of the idea that we're a democracy. Let's forget about the fact that we actually elect people. Let's just turn everything into, like, you know, a paid-for service. There is no such thing like public education. There's just private and charter. There is no such thing as national parks. It's all like sort of Disney World where you have to pay for it. There is nothing that we own together. There is no sense of community. There's no sense of sort of collective responsibility. It is just really absolutely frustrating and kind of frightening. Anyway, let me just share with you the title of Harold's piece. It was entitled, oh God, it was entitled The Empty Center of American Politics Descends on New Hampshire. And the subtitle is Where Second-Tier Presidential Candidates Talk Bipartisanship While Not Really Agreeing with Each Other on Much of Anything. And apparently, I can't believe he shows up in New Hampshire and doesn't give me a buzz. But Harold Meyerson decided that he was going to take a schlep from Massachusetts up to the state of New Hampshire.
His bank account was hacked, and actually literally in the midst of trying to deal with it. He's walking to an ATM so he can get some cash before his card is canceled.
No. So let me
he apologizes profusely.
Well, I will forgive him. But let me read you what intrigued me. And I had gotten lots of emails from No Labels to come. And
me
I just
too.
And so you notice how both of us didn't show. And they have created something in the Congress called the Problem Solver Caucus. Of course you can tell how well they've done. And they're motto, do you know what the motto is for No Labels? Stop fighting, start fixing. So it turns out when they talk about stop fighting and start fixing, if you actually look at who they've endorsed and the money they've given, it's gone almost overwhelmingly to Republicans. And I believe that the head of No Labels, Joe Lieberman, and what's the guy who's now the ambassador to Russia? He was the former governor of Utah, senator from Utah. What's his name? A very wealthy guy. Republican from Utah. No. He's the ambassador to Russia right now. Who's the ambassador to Russia? Go Google on your thing. Anyway, he and Joe Lieberman were like the co-chairs of No Labels. And at one point –
Joe Lieberman is certainly
a
Republican.
They endorsed Donald Trump. They basically came out for Donald Trump. What does that – this isn't about a Republican. Donald Trump is not a Republican. I mean, at the point in time that they came out, I was like so shocked. They should have just shut up. If you don't like Hillary Clinton, John Huntsman, thank you very much. He and Joe Lieberman were like the co-chairs of No Labels, and thank you very much, John Huntsman. Oh God, and you know that's another thing I almost thought about this morning. So maybe someone can like send me an email or put something on my Facebook page. Have we heard anything from John Huntsman? He is the ambassador to Russia. Think about this, Ken.
Yeah,
Putin is morning, noon, and night. What we are concerned about is Russia hacking us. Our concerns is our relationship with Russia. Russia and the Ukraine, all these things that we bought. Has anyone – I'm serious about this.
Yeah.
What the frick is Huntsman doing? Has he completely disappeared? I have not heard his name. Remember, I even forgot his name. What does that tell you when you forget the name of the ambassador to Russia? And you should know him, one, because he was the former co-chair of No Labels. He was he was so important in Utah and GOP politics. But isn't that – he's also what's his face? Who's the U.S. – God, you can tell I definitely had a concussion. But he's – he's a good Mormon. You know, all these things. Mitt Romney, like Mitt Romney. And I'm thinking, what happened to this moral compass? At least Mitt Romney has some ability to articulate a concern about Donald Trump. I want someone to go to Russia right now and interview John Huntsman. I swear to God.
Well,
if
Huntsman has been ambassador to Russia, then one wonders what involvement he has had with all of the Trump's
disgusting
kowtowing
exactly
to Putin. And when Trump goes over there and meets with Putin, is the ambassador Huntsman not knowledgeable or involved in any of these things?
But he's been
But the fact that they both endorsed Trump, I mean, you sort of wonder how they can claim to be
labels.
Nonpartisan or non-committed, neutral.
No position, no spine, no ideas. There's a lot of no's I could give them, but labels ain't one of them.
Yeah.
And someone said that no labels should have a warning label on it. Oh, my God. It was hilarious.
Funny.
There was an article at the Huffington Post back in, I think, December of 2018. And I was just, you know, Googling no labels, and I saw this headline. And this guy was a fairly progressive guy from Wisconsin, and he just got elected to Congress. And he'd always worked in a somewhat bipartisan way in Wisconsin. So he liked the idea. He was attracted to the idea of being able, as a young freshman congressperson, to be able to work with Republicans, get to know them, and find common ground. He was appalled. He was like, end of his piece, all I wanted to do was take a shower for him. Okay. And that's why he said it should have a warning label on no labels.
But let me just say something, if I could, about that motto that you told us about.
Fighting.
Stop fighting, start fixing. Now, if you are on a playground, let's say, and there are a bully or two, and they're beating the you know what out of some nice people. Do you just sort of say, I want to be no labels, not for each other's side, stop fighting and start fixing? How rational is that as a position when one person is this not just bully, but a violent person or doing violence to people, which, you know, poverty does, or what Trump is doing to the immigrants is? You don't start by saying, you know, stop fighting and let's just talk about fixing it. You don't compromise. If you were in Germany in 1935, and by the way, tomorrow is the anniversary of Kristallnacht.
Right. All right. Thank you.
If you were in Germany in 1935, you wouldn't say, you know, stop fighting with Hitler and let's just start talking and try to negotiate something. You can't negotiate with people who aren't going to negotiate. Just like Barack Obama couldn't negotiate with Mitch McConnell when Mitch McConnell said, I am not going to pass anything. I'm not going to let anything even reach the floor.
My goal is to make sure that you are a
one-term
president.
So we should go in there and negotiate as if there's a balanced, good faith negotiation going on. That ain't happening.
I'm.
And if it's not, it's a sham and a lie for no labels to go out there and tell people that we should stop fighting and just fix it.
So I came in this morning and I told Ken that I had posted on Facebook the following sort of little sentence. And the sentence was basically that 40% of Americans right now basically define the term right, that it the equivalent is Donald Trump. And they determine what is wrong as the facts. And when you are in that situation, I said, we're toast. I said, because it's not like they're ignoring the facts, Ken.
Mm-hmm.
It's that they actually now have decided that the facts are wrong because of Donald Trump's repetition of the lies. And again, that's how I started this conversation at the very beginning of the show. I'm so angry at the Democratic Party. It is easy to decide that the facts are wrong if you've only heard them once and blended through what the Democrats say about Donald Trump as being horrific and a liar and a terrible man and a this and a that. I don't want to hear that. I want to hear that story that they released the money to the Ukraine right after they found out that the whistleblower had basically sort of filed that statement that sort of exposed all the rot that was going on. I mean, it's just so incredible. And the fact that I'm trying to say, am I right about this? I should know this because I heard it 7,000 times that they begin that way. And I'm just and that's why when I read this thing that Harold Meyerson wrote about, you know, listen to how he begins. He goes, one of the pleasures of New Hampshire is the sheer density of its politics as its presidential primary draws near, particularly this year with 16 candidates still in the running. And then he goes on, the state is so small, with most of its voters clustered in its southern third, that it's actually hard to visit without running smack into some campaign event, whether you knew it was happening or not. So he doesn't even intend to go there. So he goes, so this is what happened. He goes, I checked into my hotel and discovered that the problem solver convention put on by the forlornly bipartisan group No Labels was unfolding in one of the ballrooms. The event featured, guess who it featured? Who, if I had to think of someone with no spine, let alone no labels, the poster child? Susan Collins.
Oh, my God.
Why did she go?
Oh, my God.
Why did she? I'm like,
why
so,
did she go? Why did they have her?
Well, I know why they had her, because she is the personification of no labels. She's got nothing. There is what does Susan Collins stand for? What does she stand up for? She doesn't stand up for anything except that she caves on everything. I mean, in a way, she is the poster child for no labels. If I had to create a composite human being, it would be Susan Collins. They said, and he goes on to say, Senator Susan Collins, who next year will have to explain to her state voters how voting to confirm both Brett Kavanaugh and Neil Gorsuch won't diminish reproductive freedoms. All right? Now, mm-hmm. Let me just say something about that. So I was looking at some articles on some health articles, and one of the health articles was about the significant spike in STDs. Okay, like 28% spike in 2018.
Wow.
What do we know about what the Trump administration has done that might be a cause and effect? They have defunded free clinics like Planned Parenthood.
Yeah.
Everyone thinks that Planned Parenthood is all about abortion. Wrong, wrong. I mean, I went to Planned Parenthood and I never had an abortion. I went to Planned Parenthood for gynecological work. I went to Planned Parenthood for birth control. I went to Planned Parenthood for pap smears. I went to Planned Parenthood for a lot of things. I was really poor at one point. I was on WIC. I was on a lot of stuff, okay? Mm-hmm. So as a result, they've seen a significant spike because a lot of people can't access health care. They're in places where there are no more free clinics, let alone rural hospitals, let alone doctors. Go to rural Texas, go to rural New Hampshire, and you'll see that so many of the hospitals and the clinics are gone.
Mm.
But you know what they also pointed out? Because of the rise in STDs, mm-hmm. there has been a rise in birth deaths. Because it is
of women
who, because of the STD, they pass it on to their children, and their children die as a result because they can't survive in utero because of the STD. So we keep saying, you know, we're waiting for him to shoot someone on Fifth Avenue. He's killed babies. No. Mm-hmm. He has killed babies. All you pro-lifers who are so worried about abortions, look at these. These are women that choose to go to term. These are women that want to have their children. These are women that can't even – they don't even know they have an STD. They are pregnant. They have no idea. Why? Because you decided to make sure that all these services don't exist. I mean, this is where I want Susan Collins to answer these questions. I want her to explain this to rural Mainers. To explain this to people in rural Texas. I mean, it is just so shocking. And again, these are numbers we need to know. Remember, I don't want the opinions. I want the facts.
Yeah.
I want to know about the rise in STDs. I want someone to make the connection. I want to know the fact that 40% of farm income now is from, you know, the bailouts that we're giving people because of the trade deals and because of insurance. I want people to know that. That's not income. That's welfare. They don't want that kind of income. They want to plan something and sell something. They don't want to cut a check from the federal government because guess what? It could dry up tomorrow.
And a lot of that welfare, by the way, goes to agribusiness.
Oh, of course.
And not to family farmers.
Of course. And that's why the bankruptcies are huge now with farmers. I mean, these
– And suicides.
And suicides. You know, it's like – if you could hear these stories over and over again, I don't care if you're a white angry man. I don't care if you're a frightened evangelical. I don't care who you are. They've got to penetrate. But if you don't know because all you watch is Fox, which mm-hmm. is the provider of misinformation, and the Democrats do nothing. That's why I love billboards. You have to avert your eyes. That's why I would love to have a moving billboard. I would buy the side of every semi-truck in America, and I would plaster it because, you know what? I may not be able to break through your TV watching, but I know where you drive, and I know how you drive, and I know that I can at least make you think twice because you'll look at it and go, that can't be true. Okay?
But
you challenge it if nothing
else. So let me just say that we were talking at the very beginning about Democrats needing to be better able to market their ideas, to communicate in a way that voters will actually understand and care about.
Yeah.
And I think that's what you're talking about, basically, is putting these kind of things, the deaths of babies and women and
And the rise
STDs
and, oh,
and from closing clinics. It has nothing to do with abortions. These are women who want to have their babies.
Who want to be healthy, but they can't access health care except through a free clinic.
Yeah. Oh. So that's what Democratic candidates should be putting before the American people and not arguing about nitpicking about my health care plan is better than your health care plan.
So I told you this is my Facebook post from HuffPost. American farm bankruptcies jump 24% amid Trump trade war and weather challenges. Now, let me remind you, this is a guy who is a climate change denier, Donald Trump, who is aiding and abetting the climate crisis. He's encouraging it. He's supporting it, which is going to have dramatic impact. You know that even if he was the best Green New Deal guy tomorrow, it would not repair the environment for 20 or 25 years. What is worse about Donald Trump is not only is he a denier, but he is actually exacerbating the climate crisis. So it is happening even faster because he is fanning the flames. 24% increase in American farm bankruptcies. How can Iowa farmers support him? How? How can they go to their grandparents and their great-grandparents who were living and working the farm forever and saying, I support a man who's destroying what I believe in?
Oh, or how can anybody who's less than 40 years old support a man who's talking about clean coal and unwilling to even do something to save the planet in 20 or 30 years, as you mentioned?
Oh, my God.
You know, he's going to kill it before they're even 30, you know?
So we're going to have an – I hope he – is as interesting and compelling as his article, which was a challenge to read, I will have to admit it, at theconversation.com. It was an article about the California fires. And I'm going to just start with this quote that I posted on Facebook to introduce it, and then we'll go to a break.
And this is our next guest.
This is our next guest. Here is the quote that I put on Facebook. I wrote, quote, "For California, flames have become the colors of fall." Let me repeat that statement. For California, flames have become the color of fall. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. A little labor history is next.
Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1945. That was the day workers in Windsor, Ontario, walked off the job in a general strike to support strikers at Ford Motor Company. 20,000 CIO workers brought the city's industrial production to a complete standstill. 11,000 members of UAW Local 200 had been on strike against Ford since September 12th. They demanded a union shop and dues checkoff. As the strike wore on, picket lines swelled every day with as many as 1,000 to 2,000 amassing at the gates to stop scabs. Then, on this day, more than 9,000 additional members of Amalgamated UAW Local 195, working at 27 area plants, joined them in support. Thousands of picketers set up a blockade at Ford's Riverfront plant that tied up the city's transit system. Sandwich Street was choked with cars, buses, and trucks. More than 1,000 cars were bumper to bumper in an endless traffic jam as strikers worked to prevent a police attack on the picket lines. The two-mile blockade and general strike were in effect for 2 days until the government threatened to send in federal troops to aid provincial and Canadian police. Thousands continued to picket. By November 12th, AFL and CIO leaders throughout Canada were calling for a work holiday to show support. Then, on December 19th, workers agreed to binding arbitration. Supreme Court Justice Ivan Rand was assigned the case. He ruled against the closed shop, but for dues checkoff. He put forth a series of rules and penalties regarding labor disputes that would come to be known as the Rand Formula. It has served as the basis for labor relations and collective bargaining in Canada ever since.
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. One of the biggest draws of a festival or fair is the food. Fried dough, barbecue, kebabs, and more. But much of that tasty food is served with plastic plates, cups, and utensils.
Everywhere I went, I kept seeing mountains and mountains of garbage.
That's Joey Diana Gates of Ithaca, New York. She says using disposable plastic causes a lot of carbon pollution.
The materials are extracted, refined, manufactured, shipped, sold, brought home, used, and discarded.
So 4 years ago, Gates started a nonprofit project called Dish Truck.
We provide durable dishes for folks to use at events and festivals instead of disposables.
At the end of an event, she takes the dirty dishes away. She composts the food scraps and washes the plates and silverware in a commercial kitchen. Gates plans to grow the project. She hopes to get her own kitchen, where she can install a solar hot water heater and wash the dishes using renewable energy. And she is exploring other innovative ways to improve energy efficiency. For example, by using the heat from discarded wastewater to help warm the next round of fresh water. So climate-conscious festival goers, eat up, and don't worry about the dishes. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
I stand too close to the fire and brush off the sparks as they fall. The headaches and cough say I'd be better off working at no job at all. But the kids' college just burns money. We pay off the bills as they fall. So who foots the bill when they padlock the mill and we stand at the gate with our backs to the wall? Something's dying. This is crazy. A town goes down, you don't stand and watch. It's a house on fire, it's a kid down a well. Sound a siren, headlights blazing. Say a prayer or a curse, lend a hand or a fist, but don't sit there and watch it go down. Something's dying. The Pratt Farm grew and it rained down loans. Then the bankers declared a drought. Ain't that the way? Work hard every day and farm till the money runs out. Each year gets harder, they live off the garden and all the pride they can swallow. Third crow of the cock, it goes on the block. Tractors and mason jars, dime on the dollar, something's dying.
So the name of that song is Close to the Fire, and it's by, I guess, Charlie King. And it's not about fire per se. It's about sort of, you know, everything sort of going up in flames, from the economy to the farm to your job to whatever to the town. And I feel like in a lot of ways, Donald Trump is a personification of the fire. And what we're finding out is that our democracy is on fire. And I'm just hoping that we survive so it's not just ashes that are left after 2020. And that's right. I'm really afraid. I just have to tell you, you know that because we talk about the facts and we're like, you know, if you knew the facts, maybe we could but not only empower and inspire people, but get them to sort of focus. California fires is the conversation today. And as many of you know, where do I go for lots of my content and interesting information from really thoughtful and smart people is theconversation.com. I'm probably their biggest, you know, supporter. The title of the piece was California Wildfires Signal the Arrival of a Planetary Fire Age. Joining us right now is the author of that piece. Professor Stephen Pines is from Arizona State. He teaches courses on fire, environmental history, history of exploration, and nonfiction writing. He was a prime mover behind the certificate in nonfiction writing and publishing. And this is the one question I have for you. What are these? He has authored big screen books on the histories of the U.S., Canada, Australia, and Europe, including Russia. What the hell is a big screen book? I was trying to figure that out. Welcome to the program. Thank you so much for joining us, Stephen.
Well, thanks for the invitation. Big screen just means it's a wide panorama, large historical sweep.
Okay, I capisce. I was just sitting here going, what the hell does that mean? So before I introduced you, and I posted it on Facebook, and I've repeated it so many times because it was, you know, I live in New England, and New England is a blaze in color. And we use that term all the time. And, you know, the maple trees and the color, and you look on the sides of mountains, and I look in my backyard, and there are these beautiful yellow and red leaves all across my lawn. But you've sobered me up. Because you started your piece, and this is the thing I've repeated so many times today that people will know it by heart. For California, flames have become the colors of fall. I mean, it just took my breath away. That is such a powerful and important statement because it really is descriptive of what we are seeing, and I can't imagine living there, surviving there, and planning a future there. So welcome to the program.
Okay, well, thank you.
So let's talk a little bit about this piece you wrote. In a way, I feel like you're over my head, okay? So as I was reading it, I'm going, okay, I don't understand fire. I don't understand all the pieces, but I now realize more than ever how complicated it is and how far back we have to go to understand how we got there. It's easy to blame PG&E. It's easy for Donald Trump to blame the fact you didn't rake the forest. It's easy to blame all this stuff. And you really give me a much broader perspective, which I so appreciate, because I like big lenses, because big lenses tell me a more accurate story.
Well, like a lot of people, obviously yourself included, I'm concerned about what's happening to the world environment.
Right.
But I come at it as a fire historian, and I like to put fire at the middle, and I can justify it, I think, because fire's been on the planet as long as plants have.
Mm-hmm.
Our whole biota has co-evolved with fire. Humanity, we are fundamentally a fire creature. We are the keystone species for fire in the planet. We have a species monopoly over it. Fire is what we do that no other creature does.
Right.
So fire provides a useful lens into that. So thinking about how we can understand the evolving patterns with the world, what is the Anthropocene? The Anthropocene for me, our firepower is basically, our environmental power is basically a firepower. And so I've come to think of the Anthropocene as being underwritten by humanity's use and abuse of fire. But there was a major shift occurred, as we all know, when we began burning fossil fuels.
Right.
And This has had larger consequences than just the climate. Clearly, the climate is perturbed by this. You know, all of our other burning always had environmental constraints. You can't burn more than nature can grow. If you overdo it, there are consequences, and you're forced to shut down. So there's kind of an elastic box, ecological box around it. But when you go to fossil fuels, there is no box. It's just the planet. You can burn day and night, winter and summer, through drought and deluge. You can't do that with ordinary fires on living landscapes. So there's no way to absorb all of the stuff that's being produced. And we understand how this has upset the climate, causes oceans to acidify and so forth. But if you look at it from the perspective of people using fire to make the world habitable, to get things, to extract power in some form or another, you see that even without climate change, you alter the arrangement of fire on the landscape.
So let me mirror something back to you to make sure I understand it. So, for example, we have, you know, in the pioneers, they had they built their fire. They went out, they cut the wood, they had the fire. They, when they ran out of wood, they wouldn't be able to have the fire. They could, you know, all the. So what are you saying, that really what happened with the fossil fuels is that in a way it's almost like an artificial fire, that what we were able to do, instead of being constrained by what we saw growing or burning, that now we're able to extract from the ground this oil or this coal or this whatever. And by that extraction, we took something that was relatively benign, that, you know, no one had lit a match to technically, and suddenly we were able to go find it, can it, move it, ship it, do whatever with it. So now there were no, as you pointed, boxes around that fossil fuel, and we now controlled fire in a way that had never historically existed.
Yep, that's a good way to put it.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, no, thank you.
No, I want to understand this, because I think it's so important.
Yeah. I see us as fundamentally a fire creature in many ways. And our quest for fire has always been about finding more stuff to burn. So, you know, we slash forests so that it can dry out and burn.
The Amazon.
We use grazing to change things so that we can get stuff to burn. Our We need to be able to burn. We thrive in places that can burn. We don't do well in places that can't burn.
Right.
But suddenly with fossil fuels, which are essentially unbounded for practical purposes, that shift has occurred. It's no longer about sources, getting more stuff to burn. It's about sinks. Where does all the effluent go?
Right.
But apart from that, just how we use fire in the landscape. So we've taken open flame essentially out of our cities, out of our towns, out of our houses. Sure, there are places where it still goes on, but not fundamentally in the same way. We've increasingly taken it out of agriculture. You can't burn your lawns, your leaves, for a variety of reasons. In landscape after landscape, we've removed it. And we've been able to do that because we can use fossil fuels to make up for it. So we've even extended that into far rural landscapes, into wildland landscapes. We've tried to remove fire from all of these places. We don't need it anymore. It's messy. It can be dangerous. There's a long tradition in European agronomy that really hates fallowing, because it's wasteful of land, and then to make it even more cumbersome, you burn it to get rid of it. But I think that's exactly backwards. I think the fallow was grown in order to be burned. You needed that ecological jolt. Anyway, we've taken all that out. By doing that, we have also removed fire from a lot of landscapes that once had it and now don't. And how do we even fight fires today? Right. If we have a fire we don't want on the landscape,
put it out.
In the old days, you would have backed off and burned out, which would have kept a significant fraction of fire in that system. Now we don't. We go toe-to-toe, putting our sort of fossil fuel-based power, firepower, against nature's power. So we use engines, pumps,
right.
Airplanes,
right.
Retardants, trucks to haul crews and so forth, which run chainsaws and flail trenchers and other sorts of things. So we've fundamentally changed it. So even apart from climate, we have altered it. And in the U.S., we had reached a crisis point in the 1960s and 70s. Certainly the federal agencies and others looking at it decided we were heading for a significant fire crisis if we did not start putting some good fire back in. If we
right.
quit this sort of this transition, this massive transition, taking fire completely out, it needed good fires and bad fires.
Controlled
fires. We
needed
to get good fire back. This is all before climate even
right.
became an issue.
Right. Right.
This is at a time when climatologists were telling us we're headed for a new ice age.
Wow. So the idea of the controlled fire, is that what you're talking about? The idea that they
yeah.
would come in and with all these federal lands, instead of the idea of fighting the fire, you would actually create the fire, because in the end, it would actually be more protective than it would be harmful. Did we stop doing that?
Well, we stopped fires. We stopped all fires.
Oh.
And this was, or tried to as fully
yeah.
as we could. And it doesn't matter if you eliminate all of them. Even the attempt to take them out can be enough to set up a disruption that can lead to more explosive fires. And also, just a general ecological rot. I mean, we've gotten so removed from fire in our daily lives. And we don't use it in our landscaping. We use it so little anymore that we've forgotten how valuable it is and how deeply woven it is. We forget how much fire is a creation of life. I mean, life created the oxygen. Life created the fuels. Life reorganizes it. We think it's just a physical problem because we can make things. We can make blowtorches and
right.
whatever out of it. And furnaces, and we forget how deeply fire is embedded in these living landscapes.
So let me read something back to you.
We've unhinged it.
Right, right.
Sorry,
so
go ahead.
Right, so I pulled a pull quote out of your piece, and I actually, again, I posted it, and I wrote this: widen the aperture a bit, and we can envision Earth entering a fire age comparable to the ice ages of the Pleistocene, complete with the Pyrrhic equivalent of ice sheets, pluvial lakes, periglacial outwash plains, mass extinctions, and sea level changes. It's an epoch in which fire is both prime mover and principal expression. That is a powerful statement. Are you telling me that what we are seeing in California, that, you know, where we were afraid of water and the glaciers, that now the fear is that the fire isn't the California story, it is the story of the planet. And we, in part, have exacerbated that because of the things that you were just saying, because of things like fossil fuels, because we've tried to almost so control fire to the point of annihilating the good fire. We now have exploded the bad fire, but we've annihilated the good fire. And in the end, the fire will win.
What had been good fire is now feral fire. In some ways, it's not even wildfire. It was a fire that was, in many ways, semi-domesticated, semi-controlled. Yeah. We could live with it, and now it's just it's out of control. Let's be clear, though, in California has a fire situation, a fire environment in many ways unique in the world. The place is just built to burn, and it's built to burn explosively. And with or without people, with or without any of the things we've done, California would have lots of fires, and some of them would just blow clear to the Pacific.
Now, explain to me that statement that it was built to burn, that it's unique on the planet. What is, having never been to California, having known that it's just economically, it's a juggernaut. It seems to be so informed. Sure. I don't think people actually understand that statement. So explain to me what that means.
Sure. Well, let's just begin with the physical geography. What you need for fire, the patterning of fires, it depends on wetting and drying. Mm-hmm. So it has to be wet enough to grow stuff and then dry enough to allow it to burn. Mm-hmm. So places that go through regular cycles, even annual cycles like this, are very, very fire prone. California, with its Mediterranean climate, is ideal for it.
Okay.
The Northeast is not, because you don't, precipitation comes almost the same every month.
Right.
So you can have small breaks.
We never dry out. We never dry out in the Northeast, but they do definitely dry. That's a really good point. I'm always thinking about it. They don't grow mold in California, but they grow mold in places like where I am. And so as a result of that sort of shock of wet, wet, and then dry, dry, what you've done is you've actually lit a match.
You've created ideal conditions.
Wow.
In addition to that, you have plants, you have ecosystems that are completely adapted to these sets of circumstances that, in a sense, are unsettled if the fires don't come in the regular way that they're expected.
Right.
It begins changing in ways that changes how fire responds. You've also got very steep terrain, significant mountains. You've got a pattern of fall winds.
Winds, exactly.
Because you've got the Sierras,
right,
on the coast, and then the Transverse Range in Southern California, running basically north and south. You get cold masses on the east side of that, and they just spill over the mountains like avalanches of wind. Now, all of this is all built into the sort of geophysics of California. It has nothing to do with people. But most of what we've done since we've settled over the last couple of hundred years has been to aggravate almost all of those conditions.
Well,
so
that's
now
why,
we have a
right,
really...
Right, and that, but I want people to hear this, because that is a toxic, volatile landscape. Take that and then take what we did on top of that, and you've created sort of a nuclear condition. I mean, people keep saying, oh, we just have to take over PG&E. Uh-uh, honey bun. I mean, in a way, there may be issues with PG&E, but PG&E can't be blamed. I mean, I'm looking at the comments on my Facebook page.
Yeah.
Everybody's blaming the electric company. And what you're telling me is no. There were so many other pieces here. That may be one tiny component, but it clearly isn't. You can't sort of fix that and think that you've addressed the problem, because that would be dishonest.
Yeah. No, if we had no sparks from power lines at all in California, California would still have a ton of fires.
Exactly.
And it would have dangerous fires.
Right. Thank you. So
what's interesting, the power line thing is actually kind of interesting. There's a New England angle on it, because you wonder, how are you going to fix the power line? And it's not just California.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Gatlinburg, Tennessee burned from power lines.
Mm-hmm.
Bastrop County, Texas, the largest fire in New Mexico, power. I mean, they're all over the place.
Right.
But California has the capacity to magnify and, in a sense, exaggerate all of these conditions.
Right.
So it just becomes horrific. So, but railroads in the 19th, early 20th centuries served a comparable role.
Yes.
And they were responsible for turning up lots of landscapes, opening it up to logging and land clearing,
right,
and then throwing sparks everywhere.
Exactly.
So you've got 600,000 acres burning in the Adirondacks in 1903.
Wow.
And then it comes back in 1908, New Hampshire, all through Maine,
yeah,
all through New England was subject to the same thing. And the reason here is not climate. The performance enhancer was all of the debris left from logging on the ground. And then you can have a small period, usually in the fall, sometimes in the early spring, that's dry. And then that is enough to power it. Well, you got rid of that, but the controlling the railroads is not a bad model, historical model, for what we need to do with power lines. And
okay,
I can tell you it's a slow, boring project with lots of dumb things like spark arresters and stuff like that, but it can be done.
Okay, so I have a question for you. Again, we're
sure,
talking about an article at The Conversation, California wildfires signaled the arrival of a planetary fire age. The Earth may be entering an era in which the natural and human-generated fire together are reshaping the planet. So I want to go to PG&E because I want to talk about this because obviously I can't put the fuel back into the ground. I can't change. But there are certain things I can do. And PG&E and what's concerning people about the sparks, just the way it was with the railroads, you're absolutely right, is something I think I can do. So I have a couple questions. Mm-hmm. People are saying that because of the kind of power that goes on these lines, undergrounding these long lines of power doesn't make sense given the kind of power that runs on the lines, and that may be problematic. One of the things I keep talking about, and I'm just sort of curious as to whether you would support the concept, especially given the nature of California, as you described it, and the concern with fossil fuels, I believe that every home should be their own power source. I believe in the democratization of energy. And I believe in it for a lot of reasons. One, because it could support alternatives. You know, you could have geothermal, yeah, you could have whatever. It would also mean that you don't need those lines, like you were just describing.
Yep.
It would also mean that there is, in a way, a little bit of flexibility, and you're not going to be dependent on the fossil fuels. I'm almost thinking that, you know, as people talk about the Green New Deal, in a way, the democratization of energy and this idea, that is what could save California. Everything else, if you're dependent on sort of the old strategy, just reinforces a bad location to start, and it will only get worse unless you change completely the behaviors.
Now, I agree, and there are lots of things you could do. You could have a smarter grid where you could reroute the power so it comes from a downwind source rather than being upwind.
Wow.
Having local sources, having
yep,
local supplies.
Exactly.
You can afford to shut off the power until we fix things. During extreme conditions.
Wow.
So, again, there are a bunch of things to do, but you have to, ultimately, it's a political choice, and that's where it gets really sticky. And because one of the great things about fire is that its power derives from its power to propagate. It spreads.
It's
a contagion phenomenon.
It is a contagion
phenomenon. So you may do what's necessary and take steps for your place, but if your neighbors don't, you're still at risk.
So I need to end this conversation. Let me tell you why. I'm so glad you ended here. And let me tell you why, Stephen. Because I just posted something about the private fire departments that are cropping up all over California to protect the mansions. And I am looking at them going, oh, you jerks. So you're going to go, okay, that house is not on my list, but the house next door is. So I got to put this fire out. Excuse me, honey bun, as you just pointed out, the contagion of fire. If the house next door is burning and you're ignoring it, you're not going to be able to really protect your house very well. I mean, this is part of the problem. We think that somehow not only can we control and contain, I can hire my own private fire department as if that fixes anything. Oh my God. And when you see this happening, you begin to realize that we are set up to fail because that is, as you point out, doesn't comprehend and respect the contagion of fire. And by its definition, if it's contagious, then you've got to look at the gestalt and not just at my home.
Well, it also strips resources from public service.
Yes, thank you, thank you. Of course, it does.
It puts it to private wealth,
which
basically,
is
which is part of it. So, you know, fire is not so different than lots of other things.
Exactly.
I mean, it takes on the character of its environment.
Yeah.
I mean, fire. I'm always being asked, well, what's the driver of these fires? Well, there are lots of things. Fire is a driverless car. It's a reaction.
Yeah.
It's just barreling down the road, integrating whatever is out there, and at certain times and places, some things are going to loom. are going to loom larger.
Yeah.
And a lot of those times and places are going to be socially constructed. So it's going to, we're going to have kinds of fires that reflect our own values and how we see ourselves and live on the land.
All right, and I need to let you go. Professor Stephen Pine wrote a piece at The Conversation, California Wildfires Signal the Arrival of a Planetary Fire Age. I recommend that you go to The Conversation and check it out, or go to my page on The Attitude for the Facebook. Thank you so much. This was so interesting. I really appreciate not only you writing it, but taking the time. All right.
Well, my pleasure.
You're welcome. Bye-bye. All right, how do we end this show?
We end with another metaphorical piece based on fire, burning down the house by the talking heads.
But think of what he just said. It's about our values. Mm-hmm. Think of what he said. In a lot of ways, those songs you picked, which is Close to the Fire or Burning Down the House, are totally, totally appropriate. It is about our values.
Yeah.